is an international organization of writers founded in 1972 to promote appreciation for literature and to defend free expression. Penn's U.S. chapter sponsors annual writing awards and a mentoring program for prisoner writers. Next, we're going to hear readings of some of this year's winning entries. The readings were produced for radio by Joan Moosey at WBAI-FM in New York City. Hetty Jones is the chair of the Penn Prison Writing Committee. She teaches writing at the Bedford Hills Correctional Facility. Hers is the first voice you'll hear.
The Penn Prison Writing Program welcomes you to its 27th annual awards ceremony, celebrating the winners of the Millennium Year Writing Awards for Prisoners. The Prison Writing Program encourages and actively supports writing in U.S. prisons by providing writing information services and by sponsoring this annual contest, which is open to anyone incarcerated in a United States prison. In addition to a small cash award, each winner is given the opportunity to work with a writing mentor. Tonight's program is dedicated to the memory of poet Patrick Nolan, a previous contest winner.
Thank you, Hetty. And now our first reader will be Michael Klein.
I'm Michael Klein, and I'm going to read Flat Top for Cherry Hill by Paul Betts from Coldwater, Michigan, which won the first prize for memoir in the Penn Prison Writing Contest. Flat Top for Cherry Hill. When you are put in prison, you are left on your own to maintain your sense of self-worth. I chose to write for the prison paper. One of my first self-created assignments was to write about the new barbering class. The instructor allowed me to become a student so that I could write a story about the entire process. I actually did not want to become a barber, but I felt a sense of responsibility for my education. I volunteered to cut hair at the prison hospital chronic care unit. Hair day at the hospital is an event and an ordeal. The entourage of barbers assemble at the prison academic school building. We put clippers and combs into paper bags and then walk across the prison yard through the scattered picnic tables full of men playing cards to a large separate building, DW Hospital. Lining the corridor of the chronic care unit was a convoy of wheelchairs. Each had a unique but equally interesting occupant. Diane Arbus, the famous photographer of carnivals, would have felt quite at home with this collection of curious photo opportunities. There were the old with their wobbling heads of white hair, facial stubble caked with dry drool, and whose shaking hands were no longer capable of shaving. They sat in their wheelchairs with their torn gowns exposing aging frailty. I wandered back past the convoy of wheelchairs. The nurse told me my next victim, her choice of words, was Jimmy. He was in his early 50s, his hair was beginning to gray. He had watery eyes, thin arms, and a strong smile. Jimmy looked disheveled. The radiation bombs that were aimed at his cancer army had been having little effect, and the war was close to over. Only his smile did not know. Jimmy was patient while I covered him from the neck down with a sheet, and I began to slowly trim his mangy, matted hair. Jimmy stated, "I guess they are going to win." "Win what?" I asked. He began to talk about his last appeal. Everyone in prison has an issue or an appeal. Without one, you have lost all hope. Jimmy's hope was gone. "Life means life in Michigan, only I cheated them. I'm going to die young," he laughed. "We all like anonymous death." Jimmy had about 2 weeks left and was anything but anonymous. He seemed reconciled to his personal clock. I asked if his family had been to see him. It was then that I learned about Cherry Hill. Somewhere near the state prison of southern Michigan, the largest walled prison in the world, is a mound of earth. Blanket buried for decades on this mound are the truly forgotten, people who only after society has turned its back on them, but also have had their families forget them. Jimmy told me these people would soon be friends and neighbors. I was cutting his hair slowly. I was not used to touching the living dead. Jimmy smiled. He could tell that his story troubled me. He asked if I could do him a favor. He wanted a flat-top haircut. When he was young and before he had real problems, he had a lot of friends. They all had flat tops, and it made them feel cool. He would like to be cool again. I had never given a flat top. Truth is, I was not all that good a barber, but I said I would try. There was much trial and error and eventually a fairly decent flat top. I took the handheld mirror and showed him the results of my efforts. "Man, those guys on Cherry Hill are going to be real envious," he said. He did look good. It was mostly his smile. All the nurses made comments about how handsome he was. There is a certain comradeship that has developed among those similar fate in the chronic care unit. A big, young, good-hearted male nurse pushed Jimmy up and down the hall to stop and talk a few seconds with the bedridden long-termers he had gotten to know. Comments of, "Go, Jimmy, they can't beat you," and "Lucky there are no women at Cherry Hill, they sure would be in trouble," echoed as flat-top Jimmy was wheeled to his room, put in bed, and locked in. His dying memories, I believe, were of the times of his youth when he had friends with flat tops and hope. Alongside a bramble overgrown path on Cherry Hill lies Flat Top Jimmy with his friends forever.
My name is Precious Bedell, and I'm going to read the two poems that tied for second prize in poetry in the Penn Prison Writing Contest. First, Shedding Skins by Henry Louis Michel of Iowa Park, Texas, and second, my own poem, Run, which was submitted while I was incarcerated at Bedford Hills, New York. Shedding Skins. My clothes were tired, so I laid them down to rest on the closet floor and watched them as they dreamed. The door was not all the way closed, and my room is far away. The air upstairs is cold and makes funny noises when it stands still. My clothes cried when I first took them off, but then they were quiet after a little while. I warned them not to get themselves wrinkled and torn, but they would not listen to me because I am just a little child. I am not afraid of the cracks in the ceiling that whisper in the night. But when the air walks around the room, it brushes against my skin and makes me cry. I will stay by them, and they will settle down, and in a little while, I will gather them. But I will not tell anyone. They would not listen. And this is my poem, Run. Run as fast as you can. Run from the punch that blackened your eye, the bony knuckles that broke your two fingers late in the night when you didn't run fast enough. Run along in the cool summer night when the hot, hazy humidity has run its own way. Run into the woods, lean into the tree, hug the bark that hugs the tree, and slide down into the dark, woody safety.
My name is Hetty Jones, and I'm going to read Reservation Superman by Paul Thunder Belcourt of Deer Lodge, Montana, which won first prize for fiction in the Penn Prison Writing Contest. My name is Johnny First Thunder, Jr. I'm a Blackfeet Indian from Browning, Montana, and I'm going to die soon. My mom died when I was little, so it's just been me and Dad for a long time. He used to drink and be crazy, but not anymore. I've been sick forever. It went away, but it came back again. Bad. And I lost all my hair again. That was the worst part. The best part is that I don't have to go to school anymore. That makes me glad, because at school the others whisper. Also, I can't wear my Superman suit that Grandma made me for Halloween. It's a great suit, but I got made fun of when I wore it to school. So I wore it under my clothes when I could. Dad says school is worthless anyways. He's a smoke jumper. He's always dirty and smells of sweat and aftershave. Dad has a picture of Mom over the sink that he looks at when he washes dishes. I can tell he misses her, and that makes me miss her too, even though I didn't know her that well. Dad doesn't talk or bat her much. When I lost all my hair the first time, Dad cut off all his long black hair, too, and we drove to Chief Mountain where we tied it to a tree with a red ribbon. Dad said it was for the sun. Me and Dad do a lot of stuff now that I'm sick again. We went fishing at Pike Lake, and I caught two pikes. In the canoe, Dad told me it was hard for him to relax on nice days like this because it was on a nice day that Mom died. I asked Dad where he thought Mom was now. He said that she was a very religious person and that she believed in God and the church, so he said she's in heaven with angels. I asked him if that meant Indians go to heaven because Grandma said that Indians go to a place called the Sand Hills, and she says the Creator, not God. Dad says it's all the same and that names mean nothing. He said religion is good if you walk the earth as God would. I asked him how God would walk the earth, and he said, carefully. We drank some warm pop, and Dad left tobacco floating on the lake. He said it was for the fish and Mom. It was a good day. That night we were watching TV, and that's where I first saw the whales. I read about them in the encyclopedia at school, but they look cooler on TV. I had just taken my pills, ding biscuits is what Dad calls them, and I told Dad that the whales were beautiful. Dad gave me a hug and tried not to be sad. He does that a lot. He was sad as I went to sleep watching the whales on TV. Next morning I woke up and Dad was mad. When he gets mad, he doesn't get loud, he gets quiet. So I tiptoed to the bathroom to pee. He was in the kitchen cooking breakfast and listening to the radio. I haven't seen him mad like this in a long time. The last time was when the doctor said I was sick and had to go through treatment again. He told the doctors that no one was going to hurt his son ever again, and we went home. I tried to be quiet, but Dad heard me in the bathroom. He turned off the radio and asked me, very seriously, if I wanted to go see the whales that we saw on TV. I said, yes. Dad said to get packed while he finished up breakfast. I already had on my Superman shirt. I just had to put on my cape. We ate breakfast and then drove to Grandma's and told her that we were going to see the whales. Dad said he had some things to do, so he left in the pickup truck. He said he'd be right back. Grandma held me and cried the whole time. When Dad came back, he was driving a 1964 two-door Chevy Impala. Dad said it was a res runner. That meant it was built more for speed and handling than looks. Dad had traded the truck for it. I thought it was awesome. Dad said it was time to go, so Grandma hugged us both and sat back in her rocking chair next to the old pot-belly stove. She was singing Indian when we left. In the car, Dad handed me a big roll of bills and said I was in charge of the cash money. I asked him where he got it, and he just laughed and said he robbed a bank. I put the money in my socks. We drove and drove that day with the windows rolled down. First we went to Chief Mountain, where Dad and me tied a bright red cloth onto a tree and left tobacco, and then we drove through the park. Dad pointed out mountains that he climbed and talked about fires he fought. I slept, and Dad woke me up outside of St. Ignatius. He got us a hotel room, and I watched TV while he went to get us a pizza. I liked the room. It was really clean, but not too clean. Not like a hospital. Dad came back with a Pizza Hut, pepperoni pizza, Pepsi, and chips, Doritos for me, and salt and vinegar for him. Yuck. He also pulled out a large picture book from another bag. It was all about whales. We looked at it as we ate on the floor. One picture was a man killing a whale. Dad asked if I knew why he was upset this morning. I said I didn't. He said he'd been listening to the news and heard that a Northwest tribe had been allowed to hunt a whale again after many years. He said they used to hunt the whales like our people used to hunt the buffalo, with respect. He said he felt it was disrespectful to kill one now when there was not a lot of them left. Dad said for now, he said we must live respectfully and treat all animals as sacred. He said that killing a whale would be like killing a grizzly or a wolf, and that would be like killing a brother or a sister. He said that this, as Indians, we must not do. He said that animals are the only Indians left. Dad said, that's why we were going to go see the whales, to show respect. He said that life is confusing, and it's best to walk in a respectful way. Dad squeezed my shoulder and said, you should never kill unless it's necessary, and even then you had to be respectful or those who you killed would haunt you. It had gotten late as me and Dad talked. We watched some TV, a movie about prison. I liked it. They escaped in the end. I fell asleep next to Dad. He snores. The next morning when I woke up, Dad asked if I was okay. He got on the passenger side and said I could drive. I jumped in and he arranged his rucksack behind me so I could reach the pedals. We put on our seat belts. I looked at him and he said, go on. So I started the car, adjusted the mirrors, and put my foot on the brake like he said. Then I put the car in gear, and Dad said to look around for cars. There was none, so he said to hit it. So I took my foot off the brake, and I pushed on the gas pedal as hard as I could. We took off like a runaway horse. Dad was yelling to get on the road, and we flew. He said, not so much gas. We slowed down, and I drove. Dad was laughing so hard, he had tears in his eyes. We had to get back on the highway, so I pulled over and stopped. Dad said I was a natural. Back on the highway, he showed me a lot of things about driving, like how you pass cars, what to do in case of emergencies, what to do about cops. We drove through Idaho, and we made it to the Washington state line in the hot afternoon sun. I was looking for a radio station when I found a song that was really neat. It was about me, Dad said. We thought it was called Reservation Superman, but it turned out that it's called Resignation Superman by Big Head Todd and the Monsters. We couldn't believe it. So in Spokane, Dad stopped at the mall and bought the CD and a CD player we could plug into the car. Then we went to a sporting goods store where Dad bought us some hiking boots and shoe polish. He said there was nothing in the world like the smell of new boots. He was right. Finally, he brought me to the back of the store to where they kept the guns and knives and told me to pick a knife, any knife I wanted. I couldn't believe it. I looked carefully at every knife in the glass case. After a lot of thought, I picked a monster one with a bone handle. It looked like a sword. When we got back into the car, I told Dad thanks and gave him a hug. He said, you bet. Dad hooked up the CD player and we listened to the CD. As we got back on the highway, he said, I picked a good knife. He said, I better keep it hid by my cape, though, because white people are a little funny about Indians with swords. We laughed. Then he asked me, what was my knife's name? I told him I didn't know yet. He said, all good weapons have names. I couldn't think of one. He said a name would come to me, maybe in a dream. We drove in silence for a while. I asked Dad what he was thinking. He looked over the hot landscape that shimmered like a lake and asked me if I knew how it came to be that on this day we were on this road in this car and me with my new knife. I said, I didn't. He said, it was destiny, that there was no way that our lives were just a coincidence. He grabbed my shoulder and said that this was a great day. He was right. It was super. He turned the CD to our song and turned it up loud, and we sang along, except we sang it as Reservation Superman. I wasn't even tired when we reached Seattle. It was late, and we had trouble getting a room because Dad didn't have a credit card. At last, after three forms of ID and out-of-state check and a big cash deposit, he got us a room. He said it was okay because the place was clean. He said it was pretty bad when you can't hardly get a place to sleep, even though you got a lot of cash. He said that's why we hardly ever traveled out of Montana or off the res, because people are too much of a pain in the butt. That night I slept next to Dad with my boots and knife on. He didn't complain. He just smiled. The next morning when I woke up, I told him I was feeling better and better lately. He just smiled. He knew I was lying. He said that all our ancestors were waiting for us in the sand hills, and I could take my boots and my knife with me. Dad said, when I feel sad, I should just polish my boots, sharpen my knife, and think of Mom. He said everything would be all right. He promised. That night, I dreamt I was running back home. When I woke up, my heart was beating fast. Dad called me a sleepyhead and said we had a plane to catch. On the plane, we read the whale book. It said that they were smart, pretty much traveled to the same places depending on the time of year, and that they were good mothers. There was a picture, though, that I couldn't understand. It was of a beach covered with dead whales, young and old. I asked Dad what this meant. He said some people say that they beach themselves for no reason, but he thinks that they're trying to go somewhere. Dad said he thinks they do it because they're heartsick for a lost loved one or because of what people are doing to the earth. Seems like the same thing to me. I closed the book, looked out the airplane window, and imagined I was Superman. I really felt like I was going to fly somewhere. I liked flying, and it wasn't long till we got directly onto another smaller plane. It was scary, but it was a good feeling. We went to the motel and ate at the restaurant. I like Alaska. It's wild, like Montana. We ate cheeseburgers and homemade French fries. Dad said, tomorrow we get on the boat. That night, I polished my boots, sharpened my knife, and then I brushed my teeth. Dad said tomorrow was a big day, so we had better hit the hay early so we'd be rested up. I fell asleep listening to my CD player. I dreamt I was flying. I wasn't afraid. In the morning, Dad took me down to the dock where the ship was. I liked the smell of the sea. It smells both alive and dead. Dad asked the captain for permission to come aboard. Captain said it was granted. He said to call him Captain, and he called him me a different name every time he saw me, like Superman, the pirate, or Conan, after he saw I was packing a sword. I liked him. The captain put me to work right away. He even let me steer the ship when no other boats were around. That night, we anchored near shore. Dad said he was glad it was within swimming distance. He caught us a monster salmon. He cooked it up, and it was very delicious. Dad offered tobacco to the sea. That night, the three of us sat on the poop deck, and we listened to my CD player. As we watched the sunset, the captain said we should see the whales tomorrow. He said he'd stake his life on it, and even his wooden leg. We laughed, and soon we watched the stars reflect on a calm sea. I polished my boots and sharpened my knife. It was a great day. The boat had small beds, and the captain snores louder than Dad. That night, I dreamt of a woman singing to me. Morning time, the captain asked how I slept. I said, great. He asked if I heard it. I asked what he meant. He said, the whale song. I said, I thought it was a woman. He said it was a mother singing to her child. I smiled at that and went to use the funny bathroom with the bicycle pump that makes the toilet flush. It's like a closet. When I came out, Dad said, the whales were here. I ran to the captain and he pointed starboard. So I ran to the right side of the ship and there they were. They came out of the water all at once and I felt very small next to them. I felt like I was standing in the shadow of a mountain, and it was alive. I yelled to them, and then I asked the captain what the whales were doing. The captain said they were bubble hunting. Dad said that means they hunt together like wolves. They hunt in tribes. Dad asked how I felt. He said, I said I felt like I was on fire, but it was cool. It was scary and neat. Dad told me to remember this day, how I felt and how he felt. That this day was alive. He said nothing could ever take this day away from us, ever. The whales were there one moment, and then, just as quickly, they were gone. How did I feel? I felt like everything was going to be all right.
My name is Johnny First Thunder Sr. My son died 4 months ago. I held him wrapped in Grandma's star quilt that night. He held on, and slowly he let go, and then he was gone. I built a bonfire large enough for all our ancestors to see under the stars. I let my son go. My grief could have swallowed the whole world. He was gone, and everything was different. I built a traditional burial scaffold at the base of Chief Mountain and poured my son's ashes there. I let him go with his pictures, his book, his boots, and his knife that he called the whale song. I let my son go. I hope my son is in the arms of angels, in the wings of Thunderbird, and beating in the hearts of whales. I have learned to accept the calm days. I feel more than I will ever say. My name is Chuck Wachtel, and I'm going to read two poems. First, One-Legged Walter, by Albert Altimari of Greaterford, Pennsylvania, which won first prize for poetry, and second, Sleeping Under the Whitehurst Freeway, by Charles Daly of Capron, Virginia, which won third prize for poetry, both in the Penn Prison Writing Contest. One-Legged Walter. He always made me wonder, eyes crow-footed from sun on snow, body slumped from slack times. He lived in Sullivan's junkyard in a gutted 51 Chevy. On the floorboard, tattered blankets, neatly sewn together, made his bed. Sun-kissed orange crate along the passenger door held rice, beans, flour, and Annie Greensprings. Coleman stove warmed his food and body. Up front, floor to cracked windshield, a pine board bookcase bulged with Miller, Michener, Kant, and Freud. Charles Daly's Sleeping Under the Whitehurst Freeway. She danced nights at the Naples Cafe, platinum hair in a tight wrap bun, thin red lips and powdered high cheekbones, 128 pounds in a lavender evening gown, spent long days pondering a he-she metamorphosis, sorting endless baggage in a muscle shirt and blue jeans, carrying battered luggage between the greyhounds, watching old people journey into dying young kids crying, hustlers vying for misplaced purses and things that turn to gold, plain brown dirty little bookstore, hidden faded brick and busted neon, looking out on heavy wheels, rolling east, west, God only knows, always a place to go, like he, she, herself, once stood 14 at Hicksville Station, rope-handled plaid suitcase, packed with everything, layered between dreams, a one-way ticket past the Apple Warehouse parking lots, past the rusted pickups and mom-and-pop sedans, past the Trier homemade apple butter restaurants, past every damn type of church there ever was, past the orchard trees, row upon never-fucking-ending row, past the lazy farm ponds of summer, where naked boys swimming, splashing, laughing, burned into his eyes forever, a burning desire to die, or somebody nobody ever knew existed, someone strange and forbidding, someone pulled through the portholes of time, someone born in a darkened corner where forbidden things are cast and left to die. She used to dance at the Naples Cafe, before he bought his first razor, before the 5 o'clock shadows and life went from days into nights, back when he was Charlene, a newfound queen and a stevedore of ships, into the night. Move along, buddy, the cop's blunt nightstick wet from October rain. Wake up and watch the raindrops on the Potomac, like a thousand small faces disappearing.
My name is Paul DiRienzo, and I'm going to read excerpts from two winners in the nonfiction category of the Penn Prison Writers Contest. Concern about the privatization of prisons, or even discrete divisions within prisons, has made its way into the writing the program has received. An excerpt follows from The New Slavery by Daniel Haar, Waupun, Wisconsin, which won an honorable mention. As prison overcrowding increasingly becomes an issue across the nation, more states are turning to the private prison industry. More inmates than ever before are being removed thousands of miles from their home state and confined under circumstances that more often than not are substandard. By the end of 1998, over 90,000 men and women were housed in private prisons, many of which have been investigated by state and federal authorities for a wide number of civil rights violations, denial of medical care, and rehabilitative treatments, poor food, and other living conditions. A majority of the problems found in these places can be directly attributed to the bottom-line issue of incarcerating people for profit. Private prison ventures are solely designed to profit from the transfer, housing, and utilization of human beings, the very definition of slavery as it was over a century ago. To quote from a Corrections Corporation of America business prospectus sent over the Internet in January 1999, prison-based industry offers several advantages, including a plentiful labor force, low operating costs, and available space. The plentiful labor force, or as some corporate executives are calling them, raw materials, are the increasing numbers of men and women transferred into the private prisons. The low operating costs are the literal slave wage pennies paid to the labor force, the inmates. Giant corporations like IBM, Nike, and Wilson Sporting Goods are beginning to see the benefits of private prison industrialization. Many such companies are starting to relocate manufacturing plants out of third world nations and placing them into private prisons around the country. Once there, these corporations can legally pay the labor force anywhere from 17 cents to a dollar and a quarter per hour to make their products. They also reduce their costs of overseas shipping. As Oregon State Representative Kevin Mannix said to Nike officials when encouraging them to relocate production from Indonesia to his home state, "Take a look at the transportation and labor costs. We can offer competitive prison labor here." So often we've heard various state and federal government officials criticizing the large corporations for relocating manufacturing plants out of the country where they could get away with paying slave wages and taking away jobs from American citizens. Many of those same voices are today supporting the growth of the private prison industry and the enslavement of tens of hundreds of thousands of men and women for profit. The following brief excerpts are from Abraham's Son by David Tabor of Norfolk, Massachusetts, which won first prize for nonfiction in the Penn Prison Writing Contest. A multicolored collage, 2 feet by 3 feet, decorates the wall above my bed in defiance of prison reality. It depicts scenes from Greek, Roman, Hebrew, Indian, Persian, and Chinese mythology. Its spectrum of colors, red, orange, yellow, green, purple, blue, brown, black, and their permutations, creates an abrupt, perhaps startling contrast to the drab walls of my cell. My collage, though childish, sophisticated, unusual, is permitted in its designated space. But art classes have been removed from this facility. Inmates are not allowed to purchase art supplies, except 12 Berol colored pencils at $2.30 a box, sold by the privatized canteen. Should the lifer who stabbed his wife be allowed to paint? Should a brutal rapist be allowed to paint? Or the young white, Hispanic, and black inmates who dropped or were dropped out of high school? Or those serving short sentences for nonviolent crimes? No. They are allowed to purchase 20 kinds of Ben & Jerry's ice cream from May through September at $2.50 a pint. We cannot buy art supplies, but we can buy Ben & Jerry's. We are overcrowded, but good time programs have been eliminated. We wait 2 months to receive a book on religion, but we have color televisions in our cells, 12 channels, including cable, and 2 Spanish language stations. We have cooking utensils on the units, but cookable food has been eliminated from the canteen, which sells an assortment of tinned foods, candy, chips, and soda. Family and friends are not allowed to send in clothing, but we are allowed to purchase jeans for $40 and other high-priced clothing items from the privatized canteen.
My name is Jan Warren, and I'm going to read the poems. Two poems. First, Bee is Dark by Christopher Pressfield of Ione, California, which won an honorable mention for poetry, and second, Poem to God by Susan Deering of Frontier, California, which won a special honorable mention, both in the Penn Prison Writing Contest. Bee is Dark. And sing the black, the night without stars, as with perfection upon the lake. It smooths the distance, horizon, twinkles velour. It waits. In repose, it grinds below the feet like a stone, seashell, or infinity. Then I, like Golem on his walk, girded at hips, turn and turn. There, my teacher says, there is no rim round eye, only the shape of the cave where drums beat and a formless kind of loss. Poem to God. My brother is a missing person, last seen June 20th, 1998, Beacon train station, New York. Blue eyes, gray hair, 6'1", limps, possible beard. Tattoo heart reads mom, right arm Jimi Hendrix. Deadhead t-shirts, untouched government checks, police stumped, newspaper articles, reward for whereabouts, only dead end leads. Have you seen my brother? Art still fighting the Vietnam War. Uncle Sam sent him home, purple heart, vacant eyes. Some men lost their lives, others lost their limbs. My brother lost his mind. One of the 800,000 recently diagnosed, post-traumatic stress syndrome, suicidal thoughts, en route to the VA hospital. When he is not in battle with himself, warm, friendly, kind guy, plays guitar, blues forte, for pretty women in street cafes. Have you seen my brother, Art, at an AA meeting, homeless shelter, sitting on a downtown park bench, society's abandoned with vacant eyes? Have you seen my brother, Art? Mom sits by the phone, because he always kept in touch. Have you seen my brother, Art?
My name is Jackson Taylor, and I'm going to read Short Time or Sunrise by Scott A. Antworth of Thomaston, Maine. This piece won second prize for fiction in the Penn Prison Writing Contest. Lashed by the wind, the flag centered in front of the administration building impaled itself on its staff 2 days ago and hasn't been freed since. Whipping, flailing, straining at its tethers, filled like a sail, it rages. Here in the bowl beneath Echo Mountain, in the flats we call the farm, the wind is never still. That's a crying shame, Luther says. He folds himself more deeply into his state prison jacket. Why don't they have someone shimmy up that pole and set it right? Luther was a Marine once. He still cares about things like the flag. I expect it doesn't matter enough to him, I say. More interesting in here to watch him, how he squints up at the thing. Shoot, if they'd let me get a ladder, I'd take care of the mother. Oh, yeah, I say, smirking, and I'm gonna miss you. I am. You think I'm kidding, don't you? I tell him no. I know he's serious. I can see him doing it. Lean, ice-gray Luther on the antique extension ladder the farm uses to repair the lampposts, scrambling up like he was after a kitten in a tree or a child from a burning building, and not to unsnag Old Glory from its own pole. All the minimum security cons on the compound will be watching him, jeering him, cheering him on, if their levity could sound like insults. You'll be needing a psychiatrist if you're still thinking about that one come morning, I say. Luther shoots me a sideways glance, the one he always emphasizes by stroking his goatee with thumb and forefinger, making him look like a wise African elder. In his scrutiny, I can tell he's stunned. I finally started acknowledging his release. One more night, he'd announced this morning, rolling out of his bunk, in the room we shared on Ewok. One more wake-up, he'd said before lapsing into silence, seeing me look away. He finally smiles a thin smile, shoves his hand back into the pockets of his jacket, and watches the flag rail against the wind. You know where you're going? I ask. I scuff at the crushed rock of the smoking shelter with the toe of my boot, not looking up. I've never broached the subject before. I light another cigarette and linger over the match. My sister and that fool she married got me in the morning. I'll be staying out with them for a while, I expect. Brother-in-law says he's got me a job at that restaurant he works at. Sounds like a plan, I say. Yeah, sounds like something. No, Luth, really, it's a good start. I mean, you got a roof over your head and a real bed under your back. I mean, it's a job. I mean, that's half the battle won. I pull deeply on my smoke to keep from going on. I suspect I'm sounding transparent. I mean, as if my sincerity would suddenly start falling away like old plaster. 11 years Luther's done on this, his first sentence. The world has long since diminished to the glimpses we remember of it and the daydreams we've nurtured like private gardens all the way from the cell blocks of the Stoneport Correctional Facility to the dorm rooms of its minimum security work form. I'd been released once, sliding back into Lewiston, behind a 4-year haul for armed burglary, and I spent the months of what I've discovered freedom to be trying to superglue and scotch tape my optimism over the streets I found waiting. In 6 months, I was pulling stick-ups. You're there, Luther. I'm happy for you, guy, I insist, screwing on my smart-ass grin. Luther Moss, food service guru, chef to the stars. Flipping burgers more like it. That and washing dishes, what I gotta do. But it's a job. Honest work. It ain't so bad a place. Well, you could do a lot worse. It'll get my narrow butt on through winter till I can get back to construction. Oh, long time till spring, he says, tapping out his cigarette in the ash can. The wind whips its embers out over the lawn around us in a flurry of sparks. Long time till spring. With an angry snapping stammer, the flag finally furls itself tight around its staff, leaving it standing centered on the administration building like a 30-foot Q-tip. Luther glances up at it, shakes his head, and ferrets around in his jacket for another smoke. He's been smoking more heavily through the last few weeks. Right around the corner, I say, almost certainly sounding confident. And I'm not far behind you. I mean, come June, I'll be camping out on your doorstep, looking for handouts and stuff. He offers me a quiet, deep-chested chuckle. You're styling, he says. You're styling. All it is a winter, and you're set up for that. You got my job in carpentry starting tomorrow. You'll be down there full time now. Yeah, I suppose. Hey, it's a good crew, he says. Beat sweeping the parking lot every time you turn around like they've been having you doing. Carpentry gets you off the grounds. It's better than being stuck up in here. Road trips is always good. And it hits me again, while Luther sits there wearing his pencil-thin smirk. The finality of it, the banter. Relying on him, relying on me. We'd been together through all but the 5 months when he'd preceded me from the farm to Stoneport. Glimpses of the end had been coming all week, Luther slipping his good hammer and tape measure into my tool belt when he thought I wasn't looking. Luther giving crazy Lenny his new wool cap because winter's coming on and Lenny couldn't afford a box of Kleenex, much less a cap so fine. We'd seen hundreds of guys leaving the Stoneport prison, dozens more since we'd been here at the farm. Saw too many of them come back and leave out again. All of them always going through the same motions, giving away what they no longer needed or what they wanted to be remembered by. It's Luther's first turn at the release game. And sitting across from him now, I know I am his betrayer. First, for resenting him his joy, and then for acting like a mute when it comes down to what I knew of what lay beyond the farm's manicured lawns and down its unfenced road. I had been released down that same road before, had seen where it dumped out and tasted its terminus. I can think of little else tonight as I sprawl in the shadows of my corner bunk and listen to Luther pack. He's been slow about it, as if his every movement and every item and every article he drops into the box is bloated with lives already lived. Veal patties, breaded. The chocolate-brown lettering says across the chalk-white box, "Keep frozen." We'd salvaged the boxes from the chow hall dumpster at noon, and this one he's balanced on a chair pulled up by his locker. 11 years, I'm thinking, shoving myself onto my side. 11 years distilled into 2 cardboard boxes and a brown paper bag. Into the box, Luther tucks an envelope of his photographs in with his folded T-shirts. He stops, looks at me, and lingers. In the darkness of my far corner, I'm convinced he cannot see if my eyes are open. He turns back to his locker, framed in the light of the clip-on reading lamp he's hung from the coat hook. I hate goodbye scenes, and I pretend like I'm asleep. But I wonder what he stashed in the boxes to ward off the probation officers when they show up at the restaurant, spooking the guys he expects to give him a paycheck. What's he got folded up in his jeans for the neighbors once they start their whisperings and then their grumblings? In the 8 years since I'd been dumped back into Stoneport, I'd not forgotten the streets I'd found. I hadn't been out a week before someone slipped a sleaze sheet under my door. I mean, I shouldn't have taken it personally. Every unit in the building had gotten one. All the recent local graduates from the state's finer correctional institutions were arrayed on copy paper handed out on street corners, stapled to telephone poles and laundromat bulletin boards. 16 faces on the sheet that featured me, right-hand column, halfway down, my name and dated mugshot, my former crime, and my current address. Through my months on those streets, there couldn't have been a single burglary in that city I didn't find myself hauled in and questioned over. The POs and sleaze sheets put me on the unemployment line 3 jobs running, having scared my employers out of my jobs. By Christmas, I'd taken to staying away from the malls and shopping centers. I mean, feeling like an imposter every time I got in amongst the crowds. I was certain that every one of them knew where I'd been, certain they pointed me out every time my back was turned, dry, sniping me with their eyes. Someone craned a thief across the hood of my car in February. In March, they put a brick through my bedroom window. I shoot bolt upright in bed, the covers flying into a heap about my waist. Luther whirls around, startled. "Bad dream again," Luther says. "Must have been," I mumble. I can't remember. I slump back down, act like I'm fading out again. Luther turns out his lamp and shuts his locker doors, stacks the boxes by his bunk, shuffles them, and sits in the shadows. "Day tripper," he speaks into the darkness. "You're walking me out of here tomorrow." "You know I hate goodbye scenes," I tell him. "I know you do, but you're still walking me out of here." I grumble something that might be a yes, hoping he'll think I'm drifting off. This morning, he didn't move from the spot where he'd been kicking my bunk, telling me to wake up. When I stopped my objections long enough to reach for my shoes, he actually seemed to consider them and told me I had my choice of boxes to carry. Following him out through the dorm and its showers of good lucks and take her easies, I'm realizing the box I'd chosen, the smaller of the two, turns out to be the heavier. It bounces against my thighs with every stride. The manila envelope with his release papers is wedged between Luther's box and the bag he's balanced on top. He's up ahead, strutting along with his chin up and his back straight, tossing out quips and encouragements as if they were Mardi Gras beads. He's styling this morning, decked out in his French blue Oxford and thin black tie, creases so sharp you could cut a finger on him. I shadow him out, watching him leave. And still, I cannot bring myself to ruin this for him by telling him all the world waiting for him out there. To speak up now, I convince myself would be as grievous a betrayal as the weeks I've spent listening to him counting down the days while I hand myself in with silence. I tell myself he is too joyful for my honesty. I get as far as the white line cutting the parking lot from the rest of the farm before I set my box down. The painted line is our invisible wall, and I can go no further. A few yards on, Luther stops, the box sagging in his grip. It isn't hard to spot Luther's ride. They're the only black faces in the parking lot, and they're wriggling out of a rust-patched marquee. His sister is short and heavy. She pushes a smile through her lips. Her husband is rail thin with hard eyes and a working man's stoop. Luther smiles at them, shouts for them to hold on a minute, then dumps his box down next to mine. "You calling me tomorrow night, right?" he says. "You still got the number." "Yeah, I call, I promise." Over our shoulders, day is breaking. Over Luther's cheek, silver through his graying hair. "Give me that neck," he says, swiping his arm behind my head and pulling him to me. "I'll be missing that ugly mug of yours, you know." "Yeah, me too," I mutter, and I choke before he turns to pick up his gear. The hands I've shoved into my pockets have fisted. "Luther!" I burst out before he's gotten 5 steps. "Hold on, just hold on," I implore, and it all just comes gushing out of me. The streets out there blurting at him in breathless stammer. I want to grab his shoulders. I want to shake him. I want to tell him what's really down that road. And instead, I just jabber. I just jabber at him as we're jamming a month's worth of speaking into a minute and a half. And he draws back closer to me as I yammer away. His mouth is hanging open. His brow is knitting. And I stand there spent, my chest heaving. I mean, my eyes are moist. And you know what? He laughs at me. He actually lets loose and laughs at me with a chesty bray, and he claps my shoulders. I mean, I throw my arms out like he's just not getting it. "Boy," he says, "is that what you've been bugging over for the last month? Check you out. You a funny guy, day tripper, getting all freaked out because you figure I gotta worry and all. Worry, me? I was born to this stuff. But you don't know yet, I swear to him. You don't know, Luther, listen to me, please. You gotta watch your back out there." He hadn't finished smiling at me yet. His grin broadens the more confounded I get. "Road dog," he says, "I always watch my back, always. Don't you think I know what's out there? Don't you be getting all sensitive, you blue-collar white boy. And don't forget this is a blue-collar white boy state. What you think South Boston was like? And I mean before Dr. King and the riots and all. Black men couldn't buy a break down there, and you know what I'm saying. When I told you about when I was 8, and I used to shine shoes with my pops out to Logan Airport, what did you think? I was being cute? Black boy shining shoes and all? Or did you think that was like quality time? Shoot, that was putting groceries on the table, cool breeze. That was getting ours. Most of the folks I knew back then, they'd think Stoneport was the Ritz-Carlton or some stuff from the way we lived behind the wall. And you think it's changed much? Day tripper, the world's always been like that. World's always needed its niggers, spicks and Jews. It's like them dumpsters and landfills and stuff. If they ain't dumping their garbage off on someone else, it starts piling up in their living room. You know what I'm saying? I can only nod. I mean, I can scarcely look him in the eye. Look here, dog, don't you worry about Luther, because Luther still walks with his head up. I got 2 good feet, and I'm standing on them. What do you think they got me that I haven't seen or that was already real? Not a thing. Yo, you understand? Not a thing, because they ain't dragging me down with them. You ain't never going to be more to them than what they figure you are to start with. Shit, he says, thumping my arm. I'm just what the world needs. Another nigger with a rap sheet. I wince at the word, the same word I'd been taught from the cradle, the same word those assholes in Stoneport would throw around whenever the brothers were out of earshot, and they figured I didn't care, a white boy like me. I don't much like it, I said, you calling yourself that. Oh, now, road dog, don't you be feeling left out. Don't you know we're all no-count niggers up in here, black, white, Spanish? Believe it, dog. The free world's niggers. Now till we're shoveled under. Just you took a little longer to figure it out, he says. And he laughs deep and hard, and I smile in spite of myself. He grabs my hand and he cups my shoulder. You a funny guy, day tripper. You getting all bugged out thinking I should be worrying about folks saying I ain't good enough to be living down the street. You a trip. It's why I always liked you. You a funny guy. And we stand there at the edge of the parking lot, trading the nothing comments and fragments we always find ourselves using to patchwork farewell moments before they're lost, and what we can no longer find the words. With a third, hang in there, and a fifth, catch you later, He slides off across the parking lot towards the family that's been standing there with their hands on their hips, wondering what he's been wasting his time with on someone like me. I turn my face into the wind and head back for the dorms.
The South African writer Brighton Breitenbach spent 7 years in prison under the apartheid regime. In December 1999, he was interviewed for the Penn Prison Writing Committee by Chuck Wachtel, one of their members. Breitenbach offered these inspiring words to U.S. prisoners.
I don't have big thoughts and big ideas on the penal system. The whole notion of crime and punishment. This whole strange system that we human beings have evoked of putting away our deficiencies. Not the deficiencies of the people concerned, but our deficiencies as a society behind walls and bars so we can forget about it. I don't want to talk about that because it's a huge and it's a complex matter. But I do want people to know, those who are there, that there are others out there who know that they are there. You know, this is very important. We carry it with us, and those voices, like the voices of the people who were hanged, they will echo with us. And the breath is there. They should know that even there's no way in which one could let them know individually, but they're not alone. And to hang in there, you know, don't let yourself get down. You know, don't let anybody take away your humanity from you. That's what you have, and you have it in your voice, and you have it in your means to keep your mind open.
If you are incarcerated and interested in finding out more about this contest and our other writing information services for prisoners, please write to Penn Prison Writing Program, 568 Broadway, New York, New York, 10012. That's Penn Prison Writing Program, 568 Broadway, New York, New York, 10012. If you're a professional editor, writer, or writing teacher and are interested in becoming a mentor to a writer in prison, please get in touch with us at the same address, Penn Prison Writing Program, 568 Broadway, New York, New York, 10012, or call Penn at 212-334-1660.
We were listening to readings of the winning entries of this year's Penn Prison Writers Program. Thanks to Joan Moosey and Paul DiRienzo at WBAI in New York for this tape.
This is Texas, the Deaf State. The Sixth Amendment from the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution reads as follows. In all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury of the state and district wherein the crime shall have been committed, which district shall have been previously ascertained by law, and to be informed of the nature and the cause of the accusation, to be confronted with the witnesses against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. That was written and confirmed in 1791. As the issue of the death penalty in the U.S. steers and quickens the storms of controversy, the Lone Star State of Texas, in its hunger for death, causes even some proponents of capital punishment unquiet moments of pause. If the American South is the nation's death belt, then Texas is the buckle of that belt. With its 215 executions since the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the resumption of capital punishment in 1976, the Lone Star leads the nation in executions. Texas may also lead the nation in another way. The highest number of cases where lawyers slept during death penalty trials. While perhaps no one knows the exact number, it being not important enough to note nor record, Texas has no shortage of cases where court-appointed lawyers have been assigned to serious death cases where they spent most of their time not investigating the case, not cross-examining witnesses, nor preparing the case for mitigation, but sleeping. Sleeping. Consider the case of Joe Cannon, court-appointed counsel for the defense in Harris County, Texas. Cannon, known as a courthouse legend in the county, slept soundly at many of the trials to which he was assigned. Cannon's clients were those who were most apt to be executed by the state, and according to one scholar's count, a dozen of them went to death row in a decade. David R. Dow, a University of Houston lawyer, law professor who handled an appeal from a conviction where Cannon was counsel took a look at the trial record and was, well, flabbergasted. I quote, "It was like there was nobody in the room for his client," unquote, Professor Dahl recalled. Dahl, in an interview, spoke of reading the transcript and finding that it, quote, "goes on for pages and pages, and there's not a whisper from anyone representing him," unquote. That's from the Washington Post, the national edition of May the 22nd, 2000. Small wonder. This is the system that Texas Governor George Bush defends as one in which he is absolutely confident. Despite the corporationist press sweet slant on the issue, there are a growing number of folks who are vigorously opposed to the death machine, the candidacy of Bush for U.S. president. When Bush made a May 13th, 2000 appearance at the historically black college Prairie View A&M University, he met messages of resistance from a number of groups, among them in COBRA, the National Coalition of Blacks for Reparations in America, the National Black United Front, the Nation of Islam's Muhammad Mosque No. 45, and supporters of Texas death row captive Shaka Sankofa, who was born Gary Graham, who were protesting for either a pardon or clemency for him. Administrators at Prairie View, according to some published reports, were not pleased with the protest. The university, established shortly after the Civil War in 1878, is a prestigious place, and its administrators were justly proud of its 300-plus graduates. Yet activists from various movements were also justly concerned that the grads, embarking on a career of privilege, not forget the 70,000 African-Americans held captive in the Texas Department of Corrections under draconian conditions. Some grads joined the protesters in shouting, "Bush, go home," and booing the governor. Such protests are a good beginning, but must be the seeds of movements to come. Free Shaka from Death Row. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You still catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone.
The music used in today's program was The Star-Spangled Banner, performed by Valerie Ash, and Against the Law, performed by Corey Harris. If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. The rich will